Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Brad, real quickly, I just want to prop our new sponsor, Silk City Hot Sauce. Delicious, freshly made hot sauce from Southern Vermont. You could get discounts and a free bottle with the promo code GOT at silkcityhotsauce.com.
Macho, macho man.
Thought we were just dancing in here.
Yeah, well, let's dance.
Do you think I'm a macho guy, Brad?
No.
No, me neither.
Wussy.
Sometimes when I have interviews like this, I realize that. You want to hear something funny about this one is I've wanted to interview Doc for a long time. He's an old friend. He's a really, really interesting character, and I thought he'd be a good fit for the show. And when Homeboy from his band kind of started spouting off a little too much, I found it problematic, personally, you know? And I was like, as much as I love Doc right now, I don't want to, like, associate with the group at this moment, you know what I mean? Because of this. And I'm doing research for the... for the show and looking into, like, you know, the band more deeply, into Bad Wolves. And, you know, I didn't grow up in that scene. So before Doc joined his band, I personally didn't know who the fuck this guy Tommy was, you know? He wasn't like a big deal to me. And I'm realizing that a lot of people have taken kind of this other side, this idea that, like, there is no racism in metal and that they're on this guy. No, this dude, no Bad Wolves. And I came from the other side, which was like, I want nothing to do with this band until this dude is gone.
Right.
And even to the point, something interesting happened. You know how, like, YouTube, if you don't clear your history after a while, it starts to stalk you and know what you like and stuff like that. And of course, inexplicably last night, who shows up in my algorithm, but a show by, I don't like saying his name because I don't like the guy, but it rhymes with Sven De Niro. And Sven De Niro was hosting that lady who got kicked off of The Mandalorian for, you know, talking too much.
Yeah.
And he's got this episode. And I'm like, Sven De Niro, what are you doing in my algorithm? And literally just because I was looking up, like, the Bad Wolves and, like, and checking out this dude, it was leading me to, like, conservative. Like, it started to think, the algorithm started to think I was going right wing, you know?
Whoa.
So I think that's proof in the pudding right there.
Yeah.
You know? Pretty funny. But I try to stay away from Sven De Niro links, you know? I don't like giving him any extra clicks, you know? But I'm glad we got into it as much as we could in this episode. Of course, there's a lot of murky water around it and things that people aren't... you know, even allowed to say at this point. So I completely understand that. Tried to get a little abstract with it. At least we touched on it a bit, but mostly we got into Doc's just, like, I don't know, amazing past, how he came up, and really, like,
he's got some good ideas, I gotta
say. Yeah, and he's just such a bright guy that pretty much you give him any topic, you know, be it casting in an action movie or, you know, the way we, going through political discourse in this country, he usually has, you know, even if you don't agree with him, it's interesting and it's well thought out. And I respect, I respect the doctor a lot. Funny side story. Do you know how he kind of quickly mentioned in this interview that he, you know, fortunately for him, was able to go to this like kind of nice private school.
Right.
And, you know, I'm from the same area as Doc, so I had nothing to do with this school either. And when I was like 18 or 19, my buddy Mike Greenstein got me a job at a rich kid's summer camp called called High Hills Day Camp. High Hills, how are you? Feel so good taking a walk through the woods. I think that was the song. But anyway, I worked there for 3 summers. It was great. And and it was on this campus of a private high school called Gil St. Bernard's. And I used to go there every day and I'd be like, oh my God, like who the fuck actually goes to school in this place? You know what I mean? Like this is like a crazy like college campus with rivers and streams and these beautiful buildings and this great area. And then uniquely, like a year or two later, I'm talking to Doc and he's like, yeah, me and Dallas went to that school. And I'm like, whoa, that's crazy. Like, how did that even happen? So between Doc's background, his family, the things he's seen, his friends, like, I mean, really a broad spectrum of understanding, you know? And I think that's why he's a really cool cat to just have in the middle of everything, you know?
Informative and refreshing.
Sure is. Well, Brad, shall we?
It's going on track!
So what's up, Doc?
Yeah, what's going on, pal?
It's a good question. What is going on? I don't know. I'm just hanging here. You know, I had 2 days in a row of just like eating the worst food and just watching movies. Like, I watched like 4 action movies beginning to end yesterday.
Wow.
Right.
And what were they? Yeah. What's
we
going
watched,
on with you?
Oh, no, just my buddies. Like, I have some friends that are like huge movie nerds like me. So they'll have like these themed watch parties. So it's like, usually it's like a horror thing, but they did action movies. So we did Hobbs and Shaw, Mad Max Fury Road. And then we did Terminator 2.
Classic.
Then I came home and I put on Rambo 2. Just, you know, I made it about a third of the way. I was like, I'm going to put, because I got a big ass TV 4K. I just went crazy with it. So, you know, I'm in the movie. Okay. It's not
a little too much Rambo. That's tough at night.
It's not enough Rambo. I don't know. What are you talking about? I was actually thinking about this. I was like, you know, so I remember when I was a kid, the first Schwarzenegger movie I watched was Commando.
Yeah.
And I immediately liked it better than Rambo. And then I realized now I'm older, I understand why. Because Rambo has a message.
Right.
Rambo's like, you know, the vets, and they
kinda
like,
deep, yeah.
They spit on us and they like call us baby killers, right? And it was like a message. There's no message in Rambo or in Commando. No. Commando's the plot of a video game. All right.
right.
And I'm like, that is, I understand that. I don't learn nothing at the end of Commando.
Right.
I don't need to like think about politics. I just know.
Sure.
One guy went and killed all the people by himself.
No, it's true. Right. It's like, because you can tap into the source of Rambo's rage, right?
It gets too personal. You
yeah,
know?
It's like, it's almost, I don't know. Well, I guess it was a successful film, but maybe almost a little too heartfelt. Is Terminator 2 the best sequel of all time?
Yes.
Probably yes. I'd have to go. Well, actually, no. For my money,
yeah,
I'll probably take Aliens. Even though a lot of people like Alien, I mean, it's probably the. I guess if you were to look at the heart of it, the improvement from Terminator 2 over Terminator, and the fact that Terminator is already a classic,
right,
is, you know, probably the biggest jump from something being great to being that much greater, where the original Alien is still flawless. And so, and a lot of people still prefer the original Alien to Aliens. But if I had to take a movie, I'd probably take Aliens over T2.
Okay.
But that's, you know, maybe that's me being like, oh, I like the demo more than the album. Maybe I'm being a little that guy.
I mean, I like how genre specific you are, because we didn't even touch into like Godfather 2, you know, some of the more classic sequels of the
time. Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. But it's funny, that actually led into something I wanted to ask later in the interview, but since we started it off here, let's just go for it. Okay.
Sure.
I know you're a big fan of action films, as we've addressed in this intro here. Now, say tomorrow, Michael Bay gives you a call. Random. You don't have his number. I don't even know if you're a big fan of him or someone like Michael Bay.
I am a fan.
He says, Doc, I've been listening to the X-Men. I respect your vision. And here's the keys to my next production. Here's the keys. Okay. Now, let's say the only thing you got to stick to is that it's like a classic buddy, like a buddy action film. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, who do you cast as the two buddies, the love interest, the comedic third wheel, and what are you looking for in like a basic premise here?
Well, I got ideas. I have movies.
I know. I figured I'd tap into something. Okay.
So, all right. So the premise.
Yeah.
I hope you guys don't steal this. Listeners don't steal this.
I mean, you're putting it on.
Nobody's going to hear this.
Just remember, at the end of what I say, just put TM.
Okay.
Okay. This is copywritten. So I will come after you. All right. So that's what I'm saying. So the premise is that it takes place in the future. Right.
Uh-huh.
And it's like 50 years in the future. And, people. And like athletes are getting like cybernetic enhancements and stuff. So when you watch like basketball, these dudes are jumping 20 feet in the air and it's just like, it's crazy, but it's also super PC time. Right. So football, by this time they're like, there's all these crazy football players. They're jumping over the place and just these crazy hulking maniacs, and they ban football because they're sick kids getting heads messed up. Right. And so these cybernetically jacked up dudes and all this stuff, but now they're out of the job. So they become like criminals, right? Because they're like, yo, it's all we can do. We got all this muscles and we can jump over cars, but they won't let us work. So they got to become criminals. But the only way you can stop them is you need some good football players to go after them. Right?
Like RoboCops. Yeah.
Yeah. So, something like that. So...
Right.
I'm basically borrowing kind of the setup of The Last Boy Scout, which is one of my favorite buddy cop movies ever.
Bruce Willis, Damon
Wayans. But I'm going to flip it. So,
where you watch someone just get smoked in the middle of a football field, first scene, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
What a film. What a film.
So, yeah. So who I would get as... Actually, okay, I'm going to do it super weird. So I'm going to flip it. So I'm going to make the old shot dude a black guy. So that's going to be Keith David. Because he's an all-time legend.
Great.
Okay. So, but he'll be like an old coach, right?
Right.
Okay. He'll be like an old coach. And then...
You need kind of that like salty thing there.
Yeah. And I'm just going to go like weird deep cut, like not action dude, but I just think it'd be funny. Maybe actually have him get jacked up for the part. Uh-huh. It's Jason Schwartzman.
Wow.
We just have him get jacked and here's the thing. We've never made a movie about a kicker. All right. So he'll be like a kicker who like he's all jacked up. He's got a super leg, can't do nothing. And then he started like a private eye service and he has to go after these rogue players. All right. Okay. Love interest. Who's a good love interest? I feel like I got to go like, Lenny Kravitz's daughter. She's pretty amazing.
She's good. She's good.
You know, I don't know if she'd be into Jason Schwartzman. Probably not. Probably like, yo, you're shot. All right.
Well, I mean, he's jacked now, right? So,
but I'm saying you're 5'6". You know, you're, you know, an older millennial, not like a young millennial.
Right.
You know, born like 79. We can't hang with you. You know, but you know, but he's got gravitas. Maybe I don't know. Maybe he hit the last Super Bowl that ever happened. He hit the game winning field goal. I don't know. So it's all across the dome. Except for the plot, that story, that's a story I've wanted to make for a while. I think it would be great, crazy.
It's really interesting. No, it's really interesting. And listen, this casting is exactly the reason Michael Bay is calling you, because of this visionary perception. What do we got for like the comedic third wheel?
Well, technically, maybe I should redo it because Jason Schwartzman is too funny.
Right. He's kind of good in that. The comedic third wheel could still include Jack Schwartzman. I mean, he can still work out for this part.
Yeah.
He could be the holder.
Holder?
Yeah, so for the kicker.
I'm trying to think. Maybe I should redo it. Actually, maybe I'm just going to do it because right now my favorite, like, leading man kind of action guy is – is Denzel's son, John David Washington. Like, that dude just got, he's got all the stuff.
What's he been in?
He's in Tenet. He's in Black Klansman.
Right, he's in
that show Ballers. He's going to be like the next guy. He's going to be basically like Denzel Part 2.
He's not Ricky on Ballers, is he?
He is the, I think so. He's like the wide receiver dude.
Yeah. Because I just saw him. Oh, you know, that makes a lot more sense. Because I just watched the film last week with him. He played like a successful like Los Angeles film director.
Yeah, Malcolm and Marie.
Yeah, amazing. Same actor.
Yeah, he's Ricky.
It makes a lot more sense that that's Denzel's son, because I'm watching that movie and I'm like, seems a little ambitious for Ricky Jared. I'm like, I don't know if he could pull off this role. And then I'm like 20 minutes into it, I'm like, good God, like, this dude could fucking act. Like, and then I was just gripped in that movie. That movie fucked me up a little though.
Hold on, I'm flipping. Okay, here's what we're going to do. Okay. All right. Keith David is out. All right.
He's out.
Oh. He's out. My guys are John David Washington, Jason Schwartzman, and then my funny sidekick is going to be Chelsea Peretti. She's hilarious.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Boom. Then you're tapping into mainstream sitcoms.
Dude, but that's not you. She was in this dumbass movie I just watched, like this, I forget what it was even called. And it's bad, but she's amazing in it. And I was like, yo, you get gold star. When you're like good in a bad movie, you get extra credit. So
yeah, I agree. Oh, that's awesome. Well, I think this whole pitch might get Michael Bay calling.
Hey, man, I got more than that. I got a lot of ideas.
Now you're ready.
I like the idea. Every time you go to the future, they always have like new wild sports. But I like the idea of like, because it probably would be like that where you have the traditional sports, but like super enhanced. So that's a good vision, dude. I want to see
It's got it all. It's got little superhero stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's got PC backlash, you know, you little political thing. It's got it all. All right. It'll be hilarious.
I mean, it makes me think too. Now I'm like, there must have been a period in time, even in like the Roman days where, you know, some major magistrate made a big stink about gladiators and the fighting, and then all of a sudden banned it, you know. Oh, where gladiator fighting's banned. And then there were just these like 300 dudes in Rome who were just like, you know, what the fuck are we gonna do now? Like, we're gladiators, this is what we do. We like kill lions. How do you want us to you want me to be a blacksmith now, you know?
Dude, that's what happened in Iraq. They fired the whole army. What they do, they end up working for the, you know, the other side. That's how it goes. You can't just, you got to hook people up. You need a retirement plan, baby.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I heard it. Yeah, actually, I'm not even going to get into that, Doc. That's a whole nother avenue we could get into with the Saudi oil companies and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, so you're home. You're in Los Angeles, correct? Like,
I live in Long Beach, so Los Angeles County, so but fun. Not Los Angeles City. Not but LA, I wasn't in the city for 6 years, same year.
Okay. How long you been out that way?
Only a couple months. I moved here right a couple days before Christmas.
What's the vibe?
Love it.
Yeah.
It's way more mellow. It's beautiful. I mean, we're half mile, 10-minute walk to the beach.
Fuck yeah.
Tons of just like, it's very walkable. There's restaurants and bars and cool stores, and you can just kind of, you know, my girlfriend's vegan, tons of vegan stuff. It's, dude, it's great. I mean, the only thing that sucks, I'm driving a lot, spend a lot more on gas and stuff like that. But, you know, everything has its advantages and disadvantages, but I love it.
That's awesome. And what's your day-to-day been like? Like, how you getting up in the morning? How you framing your days? Like, how you going about all this?
I mean, it's been an evolution. You know, I made kind of a commitment last year. I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop buying sneakers. and
I'll be rich.
No, I was like, I'm going to invest in like my home studio. So I bought, a new Mac Mini, Apollo, Universal Audio, Apollo Quad. I got, you know, I got new guitars. I got software, you know, plugins, and I feel like I've barely have taken advantage of it to the level it really could be. But at least I'm set up. I really don't have any excuses as far as if I want to work on something or develop something. I've done some cool things where it's like, oh, man, I'm starting to get okay at this. But so, you know, so essentially when all this happened, Bad Wolf started a Patreon page.
Right.
So we immediately kind of went to developing a lot of content for that, doing live streams, and then also started working on a record. So we were writing and doing all that stuff. And then I got a job on another show called Last Words, which is a podcast slash YouTube show. And then I have my own podcast, The X-Mans, which because I'm home, it allowed me to be a lot more consistent with it. So my week just became a lot more scheduled where I was like, okay, Monday is when I do my podcast. Tuesday is when I record this other show. Wednesday is when I do my live stream. And then trying to kind of fit writing and studio and also been, you know, I don't know if you've done any of this, like a lot of those like kind of quarantine cover type things. I did a few of those that end up being way more time consuming than you initially realized, you know, doing some writing for some other people. Dude, I had back surgery in November. I had COVID around that time. Shit. I've had the full experience.
Had a year, man.
Well, things my mother passed away last year, so I went. I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, I lost weight. My mother passed away, and I was miserable, so I gained weight, and then I went to keto, and then I lost weight. I've like gone back and forth. Yeah. So for me, and then we got a dog, which has been like, you know, a lot of work, way more than I anticipated.
Yeah.
So it's been, and then we split with our singer. About a month ago, and just that whole process of being on the singer search and still writing new material and that whole thing. So it's been a lot. So how did my days start? Actually, I've been doing this cold shower thing. You guys know about this?
Yeah, anxiety it starts with?
Christ, Jesus. No, you ever heard about all the benefits?
Yeah, that's the way my day starts.
So no, but no, actually, no,
I'm
that's
just saying it sounds like, yeah, it's been tough. I have heard of the cold shower. Actually, a friend of mine who has recovered from a brain tumor is a huge proponent of it. Has been trying to convince me of it for a while. What's the vibe? You into it?
Yeah. Well, apparently, what it does is it helps you deal with stress. So you're basically putting your body into a shock immediately, and. It basically makes you more resilient. So when you experience stress in your day, you actually become more tempered to like deal with it.
Wow. How interesting.
Or so they say.
So what's the routine of the cold shower? How does it work?
I put it on the water and I get in.
That's it? You just take a cold shower.
Well,
you don't have to, you don't take like a cold shower and then a hot shower.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll do that. It depends. If I actually need to take a shower, then I'll I only do the cold for maybe a few minutes, you know, just make sure I get my entire body and that I'm in it and I'm like acclimated to it and I'm like okay, and then either like today I did it and I just got out, dried out, I didn't take a shower, I just got cold. And then someday then I'll make it warm and then take a normal shower.
I used to use it as a hangover cure, man, back when I used to party a lot. It was like the best.
Well, it does theoretically, it does wake you up. So it does have those things, but there's all these other benefits to like your skin and, you know, like recovery. I mean, it's a very minute version of that because to do the real muscle recovery, you got to do in like a cryo chamber, but usually what people do, they'll go like extreme cold to extreme, to like go from like a ice bath to a sauna and like that has all this kind of stuff for your body. I'm not doing anything that crazy, but...
Did you have like a real world experience where like you're like, oh, I just reacted like a little differently? Must have been the cold shower.
No, I feel like things like that. Like I always feel like anything that involves elite performance is always in like just the tiniest bit of increments, right? Like I would say, like the difference between the fastest person in the world, Usain Bolt, and like the guy that comes in 10th that you never heard of is like 0.000 whatever miles per hour or whatever distance. And that's how I think this kind of, once you're at a certain level of whatever your field is. And I feel like I'm kind of knocking on the door of a pretty high level in terms of rock and metal, in terms of the people I kind of play with and the kind of circles I'm involved with and where I want to send to. It's just those little advantages that you have over someone else, whether it, and you see that in sports, right? Like, oh, well, Kobe went and stayed, you know, hours after the game and he did all this other crazy shit, but all that crazy shit probably only made him like 0.0001% better. But that one little edge gave him something a little bit over the competition. And because once you get to the NBA, right, everyone's great to some degree, right? Everyone was the best at their school. Yeah. Everyone was the best. So I'm kind of like that, like coming out of the world we came out of, Benny, like every level, it's very similar to that, right? When you're in the local scene, you're trying to be the best local band. And then when you start touring, you're trying to be maybe the best band of your scene that's touring. And then all of a sudden you get in massive tours. You're like, oh, now we're on tour with Slipknot and Slayer. Yeah. Can we be as good as them? Maybe not. So you're constantly like trying to level up and judge yourself by your peers, but also the people who are kind of on that next rung of the ladder. And I just feel like the older I get, I also feel like time is not on your side. So if you don't bust your ass now, then you're going to regret that you had this time that you didn't spend doing X, Y, Z.
Yeah. Yeah. Your body's not even going to allow it soon. I remember we had Chris Shiflett on a couple months ago, you know, from No Use for a Name and Foo Fighters. And he was saying that if there's one regret he had about, you know, like his 20s and 30s, he's like, I slept too much. He's like, all this time I could have been, you know, pushing the guitar, pushing some other thing. And he's like, I was just fucking sleeping, you know?
Well, it's funny. People always say, they go on your deathbed, people always say, you know, I should have spent more time with my family. I should have did. It's me. I never really think. I'm always like, man, I could have made another record. I could have worked on this thing. I could have wrote a book. And maybe that makes me weird. And maybe on my deathbed, I won't think that way. But I always feel like, in many ways, I guess for some people, their legacy is their family or their children. I don't have kids yet, so my legacy is the things I create, I guess. I don't know.
Sure. Well, I mean, that leads into something else I wanted to talk to you about even, because, you know, I had kind of forgot, actually, until I was reviewing a God Forbid documentary before we got into this, how young you and Dallas were when all this started, you know? Guys are babies, you know, and you kind of got, you know, thrown into this group of dudes who I know who are fucking pretty wild. Not like wild, wild dudes, but, you know,
they're pretty wild.
Pretty wild. Like, definitely get, you know, they'll get you. So, I mean, do you think you kind of frame that as you got older and older? Like, you know, everything you've had that's been reality driven, work driven, career focus driven has been music, like from the time you were not even out of high school yet, right? So do you think that just like framed your whole mentality like that?
Well, I always say it was never that planned, or it never felt like we were working on a career. I just literally didn't want to do anything else, and I didn't know how to do anything else. I was really afraid of being an adult and having to be responsible and do, I don't know. I just, there was this idea in my mind that work, normal work, just sucked. It all sucked.
Right.
You know, it was like, well, that's fun. You know, I mean, even like being in a rehearsal room and working on stuff, it was work and it was hard. It was difficult, especially after you do it after you've been working all day, right? You've been landscaping all day. Yeah, you have to get in a rehearsal room at 9 at night and you're exhausted. But it wasn't.
And you're a big noise nonetheless.
Exactly. But I mean, we were there fucking 24/7 anyway. You know, before we get in bars, that's where we hung out. But no, it was never this real great idea. It's only in hindsight you look back and realize, oh, I was working really hard, or oh, we were really focused, or you don't really realize it in the moment. You just kind of go with your gut, and our gut was, we like doing this. And I always feel like the best thing about God Forbid was, early on, and even before we were called God Forbid, we never had that like weird local band irrational confidence. Like we knew how good we were at every point. Like when we weren't good, we knew we weren't good.
Right.
So we always like looked up to the bands that we were, and all of a sudden it's like, and it wasn't until a certain point where we looked around and all said, oh, now you're not looking up to people. Now you're kind of standing shoulder to shoulder, but it wasn't because we thought we were that band. It took a lot of years of like we were truly humble because we just didn't, we would look at bands that were good and be like, look at how great, look at how amazing Candiria is. Look how amazing Overcast is. Look how amazing right. Gillinger is. And we really put them on this pedestal. And when we started to kind of get better, it was like, oh damn, we're starting to get good. But it was like wanting to be as good as other bands and wanting to be as tight as them and wanting to be as technical and wanting to be as musical. Keep putting our head down was our best asset, I think, you know,
right.
Whereas I feel like a lot of, and we didn't really have a lot of friends. Like I remember a lot of local bands would do well because they would play a show and all their friends would come and they would think right. they were great because all their friends would hype them up.
Right. Right.
But we literally people,
yeah, yeah.
But literally people didn't start coming to our shows until they were fans because we weren't cool enough to right. have like a social scene support us. Even though we would have some friends or it was a handful of people, but it wasn't enough to fill a venue.
Yeah, but you guys weren't like scene dudes. Like we weren't. The scene.
We were and we weren't. We were like
with your band.
Yeah. We were like stowaways, right? Like, we were like metal people right. who discovered the scene and were just like glommed onto it. And a lot of people were like, you know, they're skeptical of your motives.
right.
Reasonably so.
Do you remember anyone in particular kind of making you feel that way back in the day?
No, because we were so kind of earnest, you know, like we weren't cynical at all. And I could understand, but, you know, but I think with us, when we started playing, like that was right when we started to feel like we were getting good. And we would play when we would get an opportunity, we'd be like, we're better than these bands. Why are they going crazy for that band? And I'm like, and you kind of got up in that thing. Like, oh, it's like hype or it's like, those are my homies. So I'm going to dance hard for them. Or I'm going to, and we started to see, that band gets a show because they know that guy or their friends or this person. And we're like, oh, it's about kind of the politics and it's about the networking. So we didn't, even though it would piss us off, we just started playing the game. We're like, all right, then we're just going to become friends with all the people. We're going and we were just at every show where you just couldn't. So to me, like I said, I think by virtue of that, then we did become part of the scene. I mean, through and through, that was my life for 3 or 4 years where and that was the first community ever in my life that I felt comfortable in ever.
Right.
You know, even though stylistically I loved metal, there wasn't a metal scene.
Right.
There wasn't a group of people I could go to and hang out and be around metal. But I always felt the hardcore scene, they were all metalheads anyway, right? It didn't really matter. They were just more eclectic. They liked everything, right? You'd listen to Suffocation and you'd listen to Jimmy Eat World and it didn't really matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember even guys like, you know, both of our idols, people like Dan Sobin and John Stanley, you know, guys like that. I remember 90% of the time, if I was in the van with them or something, it was like thrash metal the entire time. I thought I thought you guys were listening to like the Cro-Mags all the time, you know?
Dude, they were the proponents of, was that Sepultura, Chaos AD, man. That was like the Bible back then.
Yep. They ever give you the cock and mouth?
I'm sure, yes. Listen, we came in a little late, so a lot of the inside jokes were a little over my head.
Right. Well, those guys they used to scare the shit out of me. They would do this thing called crusting, where they'd drive around New Brunswick and essentially just harass, you know, people on the sidewalk, yell, say something weird, and then just take off on the green light. I I've seen them grab hats, shoot people with water guns. And I was okay. And I'm like 15 in the back, like, oh, guys, I don't know about this. Yeah. This is
there's a
scary.
Name for that. It's called harassment.
Right.
Or if you're in the UK, harassment.
Yeah. If it was 20 years later, they'd probably be in prison. But even backtracking a little more, I know, you know, both of your parents were musicians, right? Like your mom was a singer. So what are some of your earliest memories of like music in the house, and what kind of music was it? And then when do you think like you really, you know, caught the bug, like where you really envisioned that this is something not only wanted to do, but even like could do?
Well, I mean, early on, I remember being at rehearsals with my mother. So my mother and my father used to play in the same band.
Oh, really?
That's how they met.
What was the group called?
I think it was literally like the, my mother's name was like the Donna Jackson Quartet or something like that.
Oh, perfect.
But, you know, my dad was essentially just a guy who would gig with whoever, you know, he was a hired, he'd do weddings and he would tour, you know, he was on tour when my brother was born. And he said when he came back from tour, my brother didn't recognize him. So that's when he quit.
Shit.
He didn't hear from him. So that's when he decided to quit touring.
He is a piano player.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you know, my mother, I just remember like early on, she would be going to vocal lessons, or she'd be like working on things, and she was really into it, but she was getting into her late 30s, like early 40s. And it kind of just seemed to go by the wayside. But my father, it was like piano was his life, you know, he would. Okay. So since he was taking care of us, and me and my brother eventually went to live with him, and he got custody, we were, you know, he never worked like a normal job. He just taught piano, and then he would do gigs on the weekends, you know, weddings or whatever. So it was always a thing, like, you know, we get in the morning, he wouldn't be gone. He wouldn't go to work till noon or something, right? And he'd be
around.
Yeah, but he was always but he practiced all day every day, and it was always like jazz radio was on all day, you know. And so, and he would always be like, oh, it's Louis Armstrong's birthday, so they're playing Louis Armstrong all day. Oh, it's Duke Ellington's birthday, so they're playing Duke Ellington all day, you know. And he was also just in a weird way, he never pushed anything on us, but he was constantly educating us in a not non-direct way. So it's like, guys, you got to check out this Hendrix record. Guys, you got to check out this Beatles record. And then the thing that was cool about my dad was he was a very kind of progressive and of the moment person. So in the early 90s, he got into Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine and Tool and Nine Inch Nails. So we were listening to Nirvana together. We were listening to Pearl Jam together, and he didn't feel like an old person, or he didn't feel like an uncool person. He was very like of the moment, even though he didn't like Guns N' Roses, Metallica and all that shit. So he was kind of, he wasn't on that train, but he liked the new alternative stuff. And, you know, he was just a real proponent of Black history, Black culture, and making sure me and my brother were attuned to that, you know, and understood like where we came from.
Where was he living at when you moved with him?
New Brunswick. We live right on
New
Livingston
Brunswick?
Avenue. Right like a few blocks from like the State Theater and all that. So we lived there until we were like 15, and then we moved to East Brunswick. And then I was like back and forth between my grandparents' house and Piscataway till literally I was like 30 years old. So did my time around that area, basically between New Brunswick, based in that little circle around New Brunswick. So it was all based within a few miles.
Right. Yeah. Your Middlesex County is fuck, man. And did you ever see your mom perform? Did you ever see the Donna Jackson Quartet?
Yeah. No, that was a little too early. No, I mean, I don't see my mother sing all the time. You know, it was nothing big, but it was like events. Or I remember one time she did like she had her own TV show, like public access show. Actually, God Forbid played on there before we called God Forbid.
Really?
And she was like hosting and singing and doing,
fuck yeah.
Yelling at people. It was fucking hilarious. Yeah, but you know, and I think a lot of that, you know, I think for my mother is a very free spirit, and both my mother and father are nonconformists, right? They were not 9-to-5ers, you know? And they never explicitly told us to get into music or pushed us. It just kind of, I think you just gravitate towards what you see and what you know. And it just, in many ways, it works against you, right? Because if you had some really straight laced, by the books parents, then maybe I would have been better at certain things or been more responsible about certain things. But I don't know. I think that's okay. But I got a lot of that from my grandparents. My grandfather was a really big influence, and he was like, you know, the kind of Cliff Huxtable of his era, very accomplished, well-to-do black man in an unprecedented way in Middlesex. Like, he was the first black man to have his real estate realtor's license in Middlesex County. So he was a big deal. And he really took my brother and I under his wing. So having that kind of like tutelage and it takes a village type mentality, and he got my brother and I enrolled in a pretty big time private school.
Right.
Which really gave us an edge in terms of education and kind of exposure. So yeah, I have a really eclectic upbringing, you know. I mean, even though like I don't have a college degree.
I'm with you, Doc. We made it without one, dog.
But did you went to college, right?
I tried a little. I did like one semester at Raritan Valley, one semester at Middlesex County, and like 1.5 semesters at the School of Audio Engineering.
Okay, you had a lot of us.
So let's just say I pissed away a bunch of money for a year and a half and fucked up most of it just because it wasn't.
Was it your money or your parents?
It was mine, I'm afraid. The only thing that's ever smudged my credit is quitting that audio engineering school and going toe to toe with them about the last payment. It's the only thing I've ever put my foot down and been like, I'm not paying that because it's bullshit. But of course, the man screwed me because of it. No, we're lifers, man. What are you gonna do? You know?
Yeah, you're not wrong, and it's this weird thing where I almost feel, I don't know if you're like this, but like if I don't, or maybe I got this from my father because he would just practice every day, where it's like if I don't keep the tools sharp, I feel like you can lose it, you know, even though maybe that's not even true, but it's just like you always have to be ready for like the next gig or the next session or whatever. So it's this thing of like, I'm interested in all these things, but I can never get away from the guitar because that's like, I don't know. It's like, I guess it just becomes part of your identity.
Yeah, for sure. I think you tie it to almost like we talked about before, since we never finished school or really signed up for the gold watch anywhere and got into something a little more steady. I mean, it's the thing you can hang your hat on at the end of the day, because a lot of the output we put out into the world is almost like metaphorical, you know? It's like you put it out there, maybe someone will like it, maybe they won't, maybe they'll buy it, maybe they won't. But I think the one thing you can almost hang your hat on at the end of the day is, you know what? It's good. I was good on it. I played well. You know what I mean? Like everything else, like what the fuck are you going to do? You know? So, and I think, yeah. And you watched your dad just getting ready for sessions and shit. I think it's been good for you because in the last, decade, you've been forced to kind of find a lot of your own avenues and, you know, you've been ready for them. So it's a good instinct to have.
Yeah. I mean, listen, as far as I'm concerned, every step of this is uncharted territory,
right? Yeah,
sure. Because you know, I quit God Forbid 2013, moved out to LA without much of a plan at all,
right? Yeah,
and just been improvising, as I say, been Forrest Gumping it through life. And some, you know, not the full Forrest Gump, because I don't count my Bubba Gump check yet, but
yeah, right, you're not that fast,
but no, I mean, just kind of trusting my gut, constantly trying to evolve. You know, I think a lot of people, it's interesting because I just had Scott Vogel from terror on my podcast, right? And and he's like the most hardcore dude I can think of, right? In many, many ways, just true, the truest guy.
Sure.
But it always kind of strikes me when I see a lot of people we came up with, like, there'll be a show or some reunion, you know, and I'm not in Jersey anymore, so a lot of stuff I can't really attend. But it's like a lot of those people, those communities and groups are pretty solid, right? Those people kind of tend to gravitate back towards that thing of familiarity. And I'm just not that way. Mm-hmm. Like I would go to a show, something like that, but I'm not looking to relive anything or like harken back to the old days. I really don't care. Like, I'm really into the next thing, right? Like for example, like God forbid, like, I'd be down to do a God forbid show or do some show, whatever. It'd be totally cool, but not because I'm trying to relive something. I would do it because it'd be cool to do now, you know? And I'm just someone that wants to just keep constantly evolving and not, like I said, don't, that's what people talk about revolutions, right? But a revolution, to a sense, if you do a full revolution, you go right back to where you started. You know, you want to go 180 degrees, not 360. You know?
Yeah, sure.
So you want to kind of end up in a new place and not just live in a cyclical fashion. Or to believe that, history repeats itself. I'm like, it does, but it doesn't. Because there's always new wrinkles, right? Like what we've experienced in the last 4 or 5 years with politics and social media, it's unprecedented because the technologies are unprecedented. So why would it repeat itself when the tools, we're completely different people than we were 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. So why would it repeat itself? There are elements that are familiar historically, but we're in unprecedented territory. So you need new tools to deal with new problems, you know?
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Well, I love the ability to change. One thing I found fascinating in the documentary, it's the last thing for now I'm going to talk about with God Forbid, just because I got to find out about it.
Hey, no problem. You talk about whatever you want.
It seemed like you all, like, thanks, Doc. you all were really pushing, but you had kind of like, I mean, and I appreciate it as also a Central Jersey guy, you know, you kind of had like a, like, fuck you, this is our thing. Like, we're doing our thing kind of here, with personality about it, which, you know, I love. And I saw part of it. So apparently there was another God Forbid from like Virginia or North Carolina or something. And I'd like to read the letter that you wrote to this band. Okay.
Brother, this is not a real letter, but I wrote one. But I wrote this for comedic. But comedic effect, so you should definitely.
Okay, I'm still going to say, all right. In quotes, dear ass, you busters need to change your name because we are getting a record deal very soon. Relapse, Metal Blade, Nuclear Blast, and Century Media all want to sign us. It's hopeless for your band to compete against the might that is the real God Forbid. Please don't write back. I don't acknowledge Mark Trick ass bitches. I'd wish you good luck, but you wouldn't know what to do with it if you got it.
Oh, wait, you know what the last line is from, right?
I know.
Glenn Ross.
Wow.
Oh, that's from the Alec Baldwin monologue.
Is that the Always Be Closing scene?
Yeah, see, it's the last. Right, so it's literally the last
he's
thing.
A genius.
Yeah, I wrote, me and my brother, I can't remember who, I feel like I wrote it, but it's still, the whole point, we were elevated. I'm sure we wrote a much nicer letter to them or like email just saying like, hey guys, you know, it's looking really good. So, but it was, you know, a way of, you know, that documentary is a comedy. Okay, let's just put that out there. The whole point of that was to make people laugh.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you got to take a snapshot of that. And go, but yeah, I think my favorite part is dear ass.
Yeah, dear ass. Oh man. So in reality, that actually panned out in a much more amicable, nice way than that.
Yeah, they were actually really nice. They were really nice. We did tell them we weren't lying. We were You're like, trying to think, was that before? Actually, maybe we were lying. I'm trying to think when this was. But, you know, ultimately, we were right. We did get a record deal with one of those labels. So there you go.
Was it clear which band had started first?
Oh, I'm sure they were first. But here's what you got to remember, that the kind of those are the early Google days, right? So that was the only way you would even know. But before that, there were always, Ben, you know this, every local band town you go to, you would see bands with the same names because just people just didn't know. Mm-hmm. You would just...
Yeah.
So it was pretty common. And half of those bands would never do anything. So who even gave a shit if they had the same name? It's not like people are offering cease and desist because some band's playing a pizza shop, you know, in Akron, Ohio.
Yeah, because you couldn't Google it. So it didn't actually matter if there was like...
Well, there was Google then, and that's the reason why, because I think with this band, the reason why we found them was we were trying to get godforbid.com, and maybe they had it or something, so it was like something like that. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those names where you're almost surprised it wasn't taken, really, by someone bigger by that point, but it worked out. Mm.
Did you ever do the demo trick where you finish your demo sealed in an envelope and sent it to yourself to pretend that sealed postmark was a trademark?
Yeah.
I mean, we thought it worked. I did it to every demo I had.
Yeah, we were told to do that. I'm sure we did it with the first demo.
You think I would have held up in a court
of
law?
To be opened in court? That's the whole point, is that it's sealed until you open it in court?
Yeah. That doesn't make sense to you, Brad?
Whatever.
Hey, Doc, you know Brad was on Beavis and Butthead?
What did you do on Beavis and Butthead?
I was Beavis.
No. Are you serious? No, is that Mike Judge?
I was in a band that was on Beavis and Butthead.
Which band?
Band called The Goops.
The Goops? Fuck yeah.
G-O-O-P-S.
Yeah. They were one of those bands that get made fun of by Beavis and Butthead. So awesome. Yeah.
They didn't get hard enough, though. Well, they were like, they did this anyway.
I think they liked it. I can't remember.
Well, speaking of moving forward, Doc, with things changing, as you said, the stuff with Tommy finally, you know, came to whatever head it did last month. And, you know, I know you said a statement back in June where, you know, you publicly were like, you know, we disagreed, but we're going to move forward. And I was wondering what the time was like from June until January, and was there anything like specific, or was this just like a march towards kind of like a reality everyone knew was maybe coming?
Yeah, I mean, listen, ultimately, there's a lot of things I just can't talk about right now because there's a lot of
I get it.
Legal stuff that actually has to be taken care of. So we're kind of in a, you know, silent pattern to a certain degree. So I'm definitely not going to go out of my way to say anything disparaging or anything like that. I mean, I could say that it was a difficult time, but to some degree, a bulk of the time being in this band has been difficult, you know, to some degree. And I think in many ways, what happened with our band is a reflection, I think, of what happened to lots of individuals, families, organizations during the pandemic, which is that it just broke a lot of people.
Do you think, I saw a quote you said a while ago. You said, you know, I respect diversity of thought amongst my team. I think the world would be a better place if conversations were allowed to bridge gaps, and maybe one day the rest of the country will be like that. And honestly, it's a very, it's a noble goal to have. But, you know, when someone like Tommy starts, I'm sorry, I meant to make this more abstract so you didn't have to talk about it specifically, but
good job.
Somebody or someone, you know, starts to take a stance that's, you know, so far one way or so polarizing, is that even possible? Like, is it possible for two members of a band to be so diametrically opposed, maybe in this day and age when you're both like either required or expected to speak on it and expected to comment against each other or with each other about every fucking thing that's going on? Like, is it even possible for people with such opposing views to be in a group functionally together these days?
Well, I think if you were to actually, if you actually look at all these bands that have been together for years and years and years, where the thrust of how they exist is not distinctly political, you would probably find a diversity of ideas in a lot of organizations. And I think what we have to not do is kind of use the urgency of the moment to not understand contextually how this has always existed. 20 years ago, we did not know how a lot of people felt about political issues. And during that 20 years, it's become, everyone has been more and more polarized and more tribalized. So the types of opinions you get that people feel knee-jerk way to put out there, people just did not have those impulses 20 or 30 years ago. So I think to kind of say, hey, can people do that? Well, that's us getting caught up in the moment. We always could. Like, I just can't think of how many people that politics was not, it was not something that we talked about every minute of every day. And so I think it's a failure of our kind of collective consciousness to actually overemphasize these things. And listen, my background, yes, is more liberal background. And I mean that culturally. And even if I was going policy level or who the people I most identify with or feel comfortable with, yes, I would say that's where I do lean. But I think, liberal culture and liberal communities are just as guilty of reinforcing bubbles as anyone and echo chambers. And in fact, have probably been more of a proponent of siloing off these things, because the truth is, if you're right wing, there is liberal orthodoxy has more sway in pop culture. So in a sense, they have to like deal with it more. Right. They like, if they want to turn on the Oscars, they want to put on a Star Wars movie, like, oh, well, there's this, like these or whatever. So they're more used to dealing with it, where I think in the last few years that part of the culture has gotten more rigorous, where it's like, well, now it's guilty by association. So if you even know anyone, you talk to that person, you have them on show, and it becomes real squirrely, and it just overemphasizes stuff, and it becomes a problem. It gets worse and worse and worse and reinforces itself. And to me, the biggest takeaway I took away from 2016 was I need to not be so siloed. I need to listen to more people, even if I don't agree with them. I just need to hear their perspective. Mm-hmm. And I need to temper myself I need to hear a lot of things I don't agree with so that I become, that is the great Jonathan Haidt, or Haidt, how do you pronounce his name? You know, he coined this term anti-fragile. You know, this idea of just exposing yourself to things that are uncomfortable so that you develop, kind of an immunity to it, you know? And also, it's just also educating yourself and not, we have a big problem on both sides of operating in bad faith, where we presume that because someone thinks differently or they have a different idea about it, they're coming to that point because of bad intentions, because they're evil. Both sides think their opponents are evil. And that is a dangerous place to be.
It's an impossible place to be. The problem is that I think there's one side that's just getting completely exhausted with saying, we need to unify, we need to unify, we need to reach out and listen to the other side as you're doing. And the other side's not saying that. They're doubling down.
Well, yeah, that's...
And it gets exhausting.
But that's because I think the mainstream left is the center. So what you're talking about is the center left who's saying we need to unify. But a lot of people on the far left are not saying that. You know, so it's... No, but in fact, people a lot of people on the kind of the leftist side of it, the people they hate the most are centrist Democrats. The guy they hate the most is Buttigieg, right? Because he's an appeaser, he's corporatist or whatever. They will put, you know, a guy like Jimmy Dore or Glenn Greenwald, all they do is want to talk shit about Biden and Kamala. They don't talk about Trump or they go on Tucker Carlson because they have more, like the horseshoe theory, right? They have more in common with the far right in many ways than they do with centrists in either side of it. So well, I hear what you're saying. Yes. Yes. Extremism. Every time, like when Obama came in, it was like, well, we got to reach across the aisle. When Biden comes in, we got to reach across. You never hear by any Republican come in and saying, no, we really need to reach across the aisle because the center is the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. So, and we value that, right? Like me, I consider myself more of a centrist, like a liberal. But so I believe that, I think part of me was like, almost wanted the Democrats to lose the Senate because I'm like, then it is a stalemate and now they kind of have to work together to do anything. Even if I want those policies, I think there is like, we cannot have a system where one person side wins and then all the policies swing this way and then the other people win and then all the policies swing this way. That's what creates.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, this like, nervousness when like this is the problem when and this is basically people wonder like, oh, so many people voted in the last election. I'm like, yes, because every election, everyone gets told this is the most important election in your life. If you don't vote, basically if it goes against you, your world will end. People can't go to the polls thinking that every time. Like that's how people get radicalized is by thinking that when the other side wins, the world is literally over.
Here's my question about this. Like, I know we could go on about this all day. It's like, where and when do you draw a line? And I think, you know, you just dealt with this recently about where and when a line kind of presents itself and it can no longer be a line you can toe. And people like us who have to, you know, watch a gathering of people and you need to watch these people we're supposed to relate with fly flags that wanted you enslaved. They fly flags that want me and my family dead. You know, I'm speaking specifically about Confederate and Nazi propaganda. I see it all this stuff. And if you went to like a liberal rally, I mean, maybe more recently with the stuff with the police, you could take a different kind of thing. But, you're not going to see anything there that's going to want to murder anyone. It's not going to want to put anybody out. And the only people who could be abjectly opposed to a march like this is like conservative Christians or somebody who thinks that either color or diversity or religion is an abject threat to my livelihood. So it's like the things that one side asks for is sort of this metaphorical threat to livelihood, and the other side is an actual threat to livelihood, you know? And that's where
life.
I'm getting to a point where I'm like, I'm done. Like, how am I supposed to reach across the aisle for somebody who's even partially okay with Nazi propaganda or the Holocaust didn't happen or something like right. that? Like, if you think that, me and you are no longer simpatico. We're no longer having a fucking conversation. I'm locking my door because you want to hurt my fucking family, you know? And that's where I do like philosophically believe in what you're talking about and have always my whole life tried to be a unifier if I can. But I've gotten a little diametrically opposed this last year or two to this idea that I'm always supposed to be so giving, you know?
Well, it's all, well, I think there's a lot there. So the first thing is we as individuals, right? We describe our own standard. Okay. So that means if someone else is an asshole, I don't have to be an asshole to meet them in the middle, right? But so this is like the whole, when they go low, we go high, right? And a lot of people in the last few years, well, fuck that. We're going low, let's get in the dirt, right? And I think what you're talking about, A, things always get a little murky when we all become extremely confident of how righteous our cause is, right? And the problem is that once you feel extremely righteous, that you are so much in the moral right, then almost anything you do to stop the opposition is, is substantiated, right? This is why, and I'm not trying to compare it to you, but I'm saying, like, this is why, like, you can have a suicide bomber, because they are so much, they believe they're so much in the moral right that an atrocity actually can be considered a great moral right. And so then it becomes about that. What are your principles, right? So if you say, well, I'm someone who believes in nonviolence, that's my principle. But then you're also reposting punching Nazi memes. So which one is it? Are you nonviolent or are you just anti-fascist, right? So certain principles start to do like creep over other principles. And so you have to decide who you really are, right? And my whole point is this. Yes, you have the person with the Confederate flag. One, let's go to the good faith idea. I think it's important to understand that most of these people, like, symbols are just symbols. They're meaningless unless we put meaning into them, right? I think a lot of that stuff is more ignorance than it is malice. I think a lot of people don't know what they mean, or they mean different things to them. So and that just is what it is, yeah, right? It's like,
that's true.
This just, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, Eddie Murphy, given that, look at Eddie Murphy giving the white power sign in 1984, or maybe he's just saying, okay. So the symbol is something we put into it. But the other element is that methodology, right? And a lot of the outcomes you want are counterintuitive. So intuition says punch a Nazi. But does that actually stop people from hating? No, it doesn't. When you punch someone, it makes them burrow deeper inside of what they feel. And it actually will make them, it will make them more oppositional to the people who are against them. Yes, well, I get the idea of driving people out of public spaces and wanting them to, all right, we're going to dox them, we're going to take their job away and all this, so that will make them so scared to be publicly known about some of these extreme ideologies that they won't go and do rallies and they won't show their face. I get that. There is an effect there that I think is tangible, but I don't think it's sustainable, because I think ultimately, do we have a thought police? Does hate and prejudice lives in the mind? All right. It's an internal process, right? And so what we've done is we've taken these markers, like, oh, if someone says a racial slur, so I'm going to slap a scarlet letter on them and then take them to decency jail. But all you're doing is basically communicating to people who have abhorrent thoughts is don't communicate it. Keep it underground. That's all you're doing. So if you're socially intelligent enough to be the most hateful person around, all you have to do is just not say the magic word, and it's all right.
Right.
So
right.
What I'm saying is, the outcomes you and I want takes a different type of methodology. I forget this Christian Piccolini guy who like reforms neo-Nazis and stuff, and he'll tell you all the same stuff I'm telling you. No, it's not punch a Nazi. It's, you got to, these are broken people. They're sad people. They're afraid. They're lonely. And they go to places that say, it's okay. Come on in. Right. So this is a big problem. Like, Donald Trump should have lost by 10 points in the election. I mean, he lost by what, 5.
Yeah.
But because of the way kind of, you know, some of these terms I even hate using because I think they're so like put in, but whatever they're called, woke culture, cancel culture, all that stuff, all that stuff essentially just turns young people to become right wing. And they're doing it almost like as a knee jerk. Like, it's not about tax policy. It's not about immigration. It's just like, these people don't make me feel like shit all the time. And at the crux of modern left wing kind of philosophy is everything is shame. It's, you should be ashamed that you're not anti-racist. You should be ashamed that you're not for trying to save the environment. You should be. And so it's just a bunch of people just being shame, just feeling shameful about themselves. And that is not a winning political strategy. And it's not a way of like garnering people to your side. And that's kind of what Trump's really great skill and kind of thing he recognized that no one else recognized is he just made people feel good. You know, like you'd see those dumb people. It's okay to be white shirts. So don't just fucking ridiculous. But, and I can say that's ridiculous in a lot of ways, but if you're constantly being told you're the oppressor, you're the privileged, you're this, then that's how you're going to feel. So the question is, yet what we have is this like advancement of abhorrent ideas, right? You had all these white supremacist organizations who felt emboldened when Trump came into office. And so they started showing their face more in public. They started, but then what did the left do? Then you have this uprising of Antifa, which I know has good intentions, but the one second you engage them with violence, then they get to, then you become a campaign ad. And then I could just, the way I get, you know, people on my side is that, hey, look who's coming to get you. They're going to pull you out of your house, or they're going to, you know, it's so it's like this idea that one extreme inspires the other extreme. And it kind of like in a way, what made January 6th so amazing in a kind of morbid way is like there was no opposition. There was no counter protests. Mm. So you just got to see them for who they were.
Right.
So sometimes this idea is like the way, just don't engage and let them show their ass. But do you know what I'm saying? Like people think.
I do know what you're saying, but there's sometimes victims to those policies, you know, because it is, it's like, it's part of the whole, like they go low, we go high. I mean, it's very complex, but that was sort of the initial thinking of the Jews.
But a guy with a flag at a protest is not a policymaker. He's just a guy with a flag. So if you want to deal with policies, you solve that politically and you get people elected and you vie for your policy that you want. But what I'm saying is the way to deal with policy is not to punch a guy holding a fucking Confederate flag. I'm sorry. It's not. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel really righteous. And it makes you like, I'm good, they're evil. And when you think someone's evil, you don't have to recognize their humanity. And you don't have to do the, you don't have to do the like origin story, right? How did they get here? What, did they start out with a Confederate flag in their baby crib? I don't know. How did they get here? But if you don't recognize them as being human.
I mean, some.
No, yeah, some. And guess what? That means it's not their fault. They were made that way by fucking idiot, shitty parents. So why would you be mad at them that they were indoctrinated at a young age and now they have these shitty ideas, right? Is that their fault? I don't know.
I mean, eventually it is. You know, if you're a 35-year-old person saying, hey, that's how I was raised about anything, that's your failure as someone who's grown up to be an adult.
Yes, but what I'm saying is we're all dealt the hands we're dealt. And what I'm saying is, how do you take that person who feels that way and change them? Is it by calling them a piece of shit? You suck. Probably you should not. Go fucking kill yourself. Oh, not, wow, you really did a great job of convincing me to join your side. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
right. Like a 19-year-old on Twitter told me to kill myself. I'm going to change my whole way of thinking.
No, but I agree with you in the abstract. I agree with you on like who's on the right side of history. I agree with you in terms of kind of the moral end of things. Where I disagree is the methodology and how to get the outcomes you seek. Because people, so that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's all counterintuitive. It's all, the thing you think is going to work doesn't work, right? It's like, wow, every time we shoot the bad guy with guns, he gets stronger. And that's what it is. It's like you have to be more deft and you have to be more compassionate. And yeah, and it requires you to always be the adult in the room. And it sucks.
Right.
It does, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, speaking of stuff like this, like, we're going to stop there. Since there's so, like, you know, and I just did it to you, since there's so few, you know, black people in the hard rock and metal scene, do you often find yourself in a position where you, like, are forced to represent, like, the entire community? And is that tiresome for you, or do you like jump at the chance to try to?
Well,
I'm sorry, tell by the thing, way, like, for doing it to you again.
Oh no, I don't care. Well, one, there's like some people would always ask that kind of about God forbid, like, oh, you know, black man. I'm like, I'll say this, you know what? It's better to be known as the black man than not be known for anything. there's so many bands that don't have any identity or any like thing that's their thing.
That's true.
Listen, I think there is a, that's actually more broad of a question than I think what you're actually addressing is.
Okay.
And to me, the bigger issue or the bigger like thing we're trying to navigate is actually not necessarily that there's less amount of diversity in hard rock or metal or hardcore or whatever. It's that actually for in America, the black community is less welcoming of stuff that's considered white. So the black people that end up getting into that stuff are kind of like getting it from both ends, mm-hmm. because they're kind of an outlier in their initial communities or families. And then they're also end up kind of being this, an outlier in the communities that they kind of go into. So I think it speaks a little more to those people that end up getting into these things, you know? And so already you're kind of an individual that goes against the grain, right? Mm-hmm. That does things that aren't expected of you. That is,
right.
Hey, I'm going to be kind of a cultural tourist, right? I'm going to try different things. I'm going to be open-minded, you know? Mm-hmm. So kind of whatever comes along with that, I've always been perfectly fine being an ambassador of that or speaking to those issues, because I think they're utterly fascinating. You know, when I go out of my way to have black artists on my show, women on my show, gay people on my show, to speak to whatever, you know, whatever that experience is like, because it just is what it is. And this, like I said, this goes back to kind of like my good faith thing. Metal, the world I come from, isn't white male, because majority white male, because it's trying to be that way. It just is. It's just a suburban kind of middle class thing. You know, heavy metal is created by Black Sabbath and Judas Priest and Iron Maiden in England. It's culturally European. Right. It's just what it is. And it's like,
sure.
People just vibe with whatever they vibe with. You know, it just is what it is. So,
yeah.
But I do think that to me, the most important thing is actually to really permeate American black culture, or what is kind of like the de facto idea of hip hop culture, which is now pop culture, right?
Yeah.
It's okay for young black kids to listen to things that aren't hip hop and R&B. It's okay to play instruments. It's to me, that's because the problem isn't that white people aren't letting black people go to shows. It's that American black culture is basically the way black culture is in America, is that they're very innovative. So when they, and very fashionable. So it's like, oh that song, right. Oh, that was last week's song. Oh, that outfit? No, we don't dress like that. Like, it's very much, it's a very short memory, right? They're always on to the new thing. So, oh, we were doing blues, now we were doing jazz, we're under this. We're doing this. So whereas rock and metal culture, which said, which is more European in nature, is all about history, right? It's all about, oh, we're going to the festival, and it's all about we're going to see Motorhead because that's the we love. It's you know, we're going. You know, it's very much about gaining this kind of historical credibility and attaining to that. You'll go see some kids, some 15-year-old kid at a festival with patches on, and it's all old bands, right? You like you almost have to be like a really badass new band for them to put your patch on, right?
Right.
So that those are cultural differences where one is about understanding history and being of a certain stature, and others is about, well, if you're last week, I'm not even paying attention to you. I'm moving on to the next thing. So that's kind of at the core of it.
Yeah.
I think. But I think if the Black community opened up itself a little more to those things, then you'd have way more Black people at the shows. So I don't really, I think it's a little more, again, it's a little more different than I think people look at it. But I have no problem talking about it because I think that's where all the interesting shit is. You know, it's like, but it's always, it's never
in the murky middle.
Well, no, I said, but people always want to kind of ask, you know, oh, what's it? So how racist is everyone else? I'm like, no, people, I mean, I don't know. If they ain't racist. They ain't racist to my face. They wait for I leave. So I don't know, you know, or it's things they, or it's things they, people don't even realize. They're trying to be nice.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I think, because the truth is it's, in many ways, it's like the Obama vote, right? A lot of white people, that shit, that vote made them feel good. It's like, oh, look, I feel so not racist. Oh, yes, vote. So sometimes I think it's the same way with seeing
appeal the Band-Aid.
Yeah, but no, but I think there's something good. In the same way, like giving to charity makes you feel good, right?
Yeah.
This idea that I'm benevolent, you know, I think that it's the same way in the metal scene where if they see a Black artist that they really like or they kick ass, they're like, I think they do want to be inclusive. They do. It makes like, oh yeah, like they'll like them even more just because the, I don't know. So there's an element of that. Right. And then there's another thing, you know, see, I don't know if I should be telling you guys about this, but, you know, there's a lot of Black dudes that, you know, or this was, you know, you ever see that scene in Not Another Teen Movie with where the one dude from Kent, was it the dancing movie? I don't know. There's two Black dudes at the party. And the one dude's like, yo, man, I'm supposed to be the only Black dude at this party. And he leaves. So my brothers, they like being the only Black dude at the party. They like that. They're like, yeah, it's great.
Right.
I'm the Black dude. That's what, you know, they you know, there's a little bit of that. Not me, but there's a couple of them out there. They're like, yo, what you doing on my block? I'm supposed to be the token dude here. You know, so there's a little bit of that too.
Do you think that's just like a feeling of like, in any context, is that just like a person finding like a small avenue to just feel exceptional, to just feel independent and like one of a kind? Like, is that where that impulse comes from?
Everyone wants to be special, one.
Right.
Yeah. Two, I think, you know, I'm really fascinated by Black conservatives, right? Because it's a through line. Like, there's a lot of the ideas around it are very consistent through people become Black, especially I can only speak to America. I don't know as much about across the pond, but
sure.
I think a lot of it, that the thrust of Black conservatism is the idea that my Blackness is not the kind of most defining thing about
me,
right? It's this idea of wanting to kind of graduate out of that. And that is kind of consistent, I think, with a lot of conservative orthodoxy is like, well, we want to, it's not about being Black, but to the point where it doesn't recognize it, right? And I think there's people, you know, like someone like Bakari Sellers, for example, where he's like, being Black is the most important thing about his personality. And I don't agree with that. I think it's like, really?
Right.
Something, you know, it's like you didn't have a choice and that just is what it is. But whether you completely ignore it or you completely highlight it, you know, I'm not saying there's one right way to be, but there is this idea that once you kind of extricate yourself from that like me being Black is kind of just a matter of fact, like, well, I happen to be Black, but it's not really a thing. Then it allows you to kind of, in a sense, I think it's tied to like these ideas of success and social mobility, right? It's like, well, I can be this. Mm-hmm. I can go. I can be an executive over here. I can go move to this place because I'm not completely defined by this one thing. And a lot of that I totally get. And I think it's actually, I think anyone, especially if you rewind the clock to any Black professional that made strides at a time where a lot of Black people were getting through, you had to kind of like put that aside and just like, well, I'm here because I deserve to be here. And it's not about that. I don't know how I got on this.
Did you watch your grandfather have to do that at all?
Yeah, but there was, but to a certain degree, I think, it's like a spiky ball there, because there's a lot of kind of intra politics in within the social framework of even Black communities between like, oh, well, this like me, I'm very light skinned. It's very, my grandfather was very, very light skinned. Maybe that gave him advantages in some ways. And we see like Barack Obama became president. Barack Obama was mixed, right? He was biracial, right? We call him the first Black president, but he was biracial. And there's this idea that you, to succeed, I think in the 50s and the 60s, you had to downplay your Blackness, right? The way you speak, the way you dress, the way you kind of, you had to kind of conform to certain norms to kind of move forward. And, and we saw now there was a real diffusion of that in the 70s with the Black Power movement. That was the kind of preceding hip hop culture, and a lot of stuff kind of changed with that. But I think there's a lot of, at the heart of kind of conservative ideology is this idea of conforming, right? It's like, well, if you're a refugee, you move to a country, you have to assimilate.
Assimilate.
Right? And so there's the practical side of that where it's like, fuck yeah, you need to assimilate, you try to get a job, make some money. And then there's the like kind of cultural pride element of like, well, why do I got to change? Why do we got to, you know? And I kind of get both sides of it. And I'm probably a little more on the, let's just get your shit done. Don't worry about it too much. Like I said, I don't know. Do we go down a rabbit hole? I feel like am I going off topic?
No, I asked you this question. So it's actually still very specifically on topic. It's funny. My father is just expressing to me something where him and his friends in the 40s and 50s, you know, being, first generation immigrants, their parents from, European Jews, that him and his friends kind of overly adopted like American macho culture. They wouldn't learn Yiddish. They wouldn't wear yarmulke. They wouldn't like, and it was this idea that like the European Jew got fucked and they were too weak, and that we're like Americans and like, we don't speak those old languages. We don't do this. We're more strong. We're different, you know? And it was kind of this, like you were talking about this, meeting of, imagining whatever is the issues of the past with exactly what you want to be and holding on to your identity. It's very complicated.
Yeah. And by the way, and the way I look at it is again, in a good faith framework of just trying to see these patterns and understand people think a little differently and go, okay, everything they're coming with is not wrong, right? There's utility. utility to that stuff. And it's about, I think, finding a balance. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Obama, and in his, there's a movie, or I don't know, it's a series or movie that came out that kind of talked about his college years where he was trying to figure out who he was, right? Mm. He was trying, because he was so well educated and he was kind of pretty much raised by his mother and in white environments, when he went to college, he felt disconnected from his Blackness, right? Mm. But here's the question. What does that mean? What does Black, what does authentically being Black even mean? Right? Is it listening to a certain kind of music? Is it having a certain kind of haircut? Is it spending time with certain people? And everyone has to kind of figure that out. I, you know, And it's something I think a lot of biracial people, especially in America, especially in the last 50 years, kind of have to have this internal dialogue with themselves about figuring out who they are. And my, I think I've seen that manifest in a lot of different ways, in some ways that I'm not really comfortable with other people. And I'm like, I feel they got trapped in feeling like, God damn, they got trapped in a way where they felt like, oh, well, the way I can be black is to, I need to listen to this kind of music. I need to dress this way. I need to. And I think that's, unfortunately, I think it's reductive. I think it's shallow. And me, I kind of look at things in a more of a smorgasbord type of mentality. Like, one of my favorite blogs back in the day was Stuff White People Like. And it was kind of like making fun of hipsters. I kind of looked at this list and I was like, check, check, check. Kind of going through. But at the same time, like, I had the benefit of really existing in both worlds. I grew up in a black community that was lower class and urban, right? And I got to go to a private school that was mostly white and wealthy. And I got to spend time with these parents and spend time with this family and really exist in both worlds. And that's a great social education because it's not everything you would think it would be. It's not like, oh, this is like this and that is like that. It's actually a lot more complex. Like, my black family was more wealthy and proper, like, you know, didn't curse. My white side of my family was cursing up the joint and drinking. Like, it was not exactly what, it was not tied to stereotypes, you know, quite as much as people think. But I also realized, like, I don't think you have to choose, you know? I mean, you could say by default what I do, say, oh, he chose. He's a heavy metal guitar player, so he decided. He went white.
Right.
You know? And I guess, you know, an argument can be made for that. But, you know, I don't know. I choose to take from the whole kind of bouquet of culture and absorb what I want when I want. You know, I don't think
you're a beautiful, beautiful, complex man, Doc. You are.
That's right. I got me a New Jack City poster right there, keeping me straight.
Ice is looking down at you. He's like, hey,
but sit your $5 ass down before I make change.
Don't play too much guitar. All right. So I've had you for a million years already and we haven't had that much fun. So I want to do a couple of our fun things right here at the end, just so we can pepper in a little joy to the program, you know? So this is a little segment, Doc, we call Mystery Fret, where I'm going to prompt you on a story, something that happened, and I would like you to tell me that story, get into it a little bit, and try to guess which mystery friend of yours told it. So apparently you were once at a movie theater in Hollywood. This would be Los Angeles. And you were seeing a film. I'll give you the film if you need it. And accidentally crashed the celebrity-studded John Wick 2 pre-release screening. What was that all about?
Well, it's, I mean, I'm sure my girlfriend must have told you that.
No. Right? No.
Or did Joe True?
No. Who's that with? Oh, I'm glad I actually
Luke, did Luke. Oh, Luke probably told you.
It's Luke.
Yeah. I had to think about all the people I went to movies with. So if you go to the Arclight in Hollywood, they do a lot of premieres there. So, or like pre-screening. So you go there on almost, well, when theaters were open, you know, you could go there on any given night and you would see all kinds
in
of
the 80s. People.
The 80s, you know, not that long ago. Feels so, like, yeah, I mean, it's pretty, yeah, was it John Wick? I remember there was one, I remember there was a Joker one. There was, you know, it's L.A. You know, I mean, listen, the first day I was in L.A., went to Veggie Grill, and Davey Havoc was there and Moby.
Oh.
And Davey Havoc was dressed like Elvis.
Independently.
Independently. This is just, by the way, right next to that same arc light. So who knows what was showing that day.
Okay. So who did you see coming out of John Wick 2?
I'm trying to remember. I saw the guy that's in the movie who was also in Fargo. The guy who puts Steve Buscemi into the wood chipper.
Yeah, sure. We stopped at the pancakes house.
I remember seeing him specifically, but he was in the movie. And I'm trying to remember who else. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. I remember I went to go see some movie, not even there, but at another theater, not even close to there. And James Woods was there. And they were like, what did he go see? He was talking about, I think he went to go see The Jungle Book. I think he was talking about how great it was.
All right.
He seemed really, you know, like he's notoriously like an asshole, but he seemed really nice and being nice to people. So I don't know.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's LA. It's kind of you see enough, you don't even pay attention anymore, you know?
Yeah. Has it happened to you? Or someone's like, oh shit, that's Doc Coyle coming out of the film.
I mean, people recognize me. I'm just trying to think if it's happened in a movie. Not that I remember. It's kind of, here's what's funny. So I'm such a movie nerd, right?
Yeah.
And I would go to the New Beverly, which is Tarantino's theater. And you know,
the Patton Oswalt books. He wrote basically like a book that's about his experience going to the New Beverly like 5 times a week for a couple years.
Well, that's perfect because literally every guy that's there looks like Patton Oswalt. It's just like,
of course,
nerd city, right? And it's funny. Me, I'm there. I'll be like looking all rock and roll, and I'm like, I'm not like these people, but I'm like them, but I'm not like them, right? Like it's right, like things could have, you know, it's like, but in my heart, I'm a nerd, but it's just funny, like being around all these people. But I go there and
you're like, I'm in the same place as you, but I'll bust your ass if I have to.
No, I won't bust your ass. I'm just this really. I get to do this, and then I go and play on stage and be a cool guy. And you're just this is it for you. This is it. This is behind a computer. I get it. I'm like, but in some ways I look around and go, this is my tribe. These are my people. Really.
Right. Yeah.
So usually like something like that, I would just run into people I actually know at New Beverly when it was still
open. Oh, okay.
I miss it dearly. I mean, it shows stuff in 35mm. They would do midnight movies on Fridays and Saturdays. Usually there'd be like a Tarantino movie of the week. I mean, and that like popcorn's like $2. I'd sneak booze in. It's great.
Love it.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, that book is called, it was right behind me. Silver Screen Fiend. It's really entertaining. Yeah. It's just about him being the biggest nerd for a couple years. All right. So Doc, it was a time apparently.
He's still a nerd. All right. Come on.
Yeah. The biggest, so you're essentially New Jersey heavy music royalty at this point, even though you've left us and sold out just a little bit.
I did.
So if you're making, say you meet one of these cool people, you meet someone from like Super Bad or something at the fucking, you know, In-N-Out Burger, and they're like, hey, could you make me a mixtape? So if you're making the essential New Jersey heavy music mixtape, I'm talking hardcore, metal, anything heavy music. Who's got to be on it?
Who's got to be on it? I mean, opening track's got to be E-Town. That's the jerseyest band ever. All right. They need like three tracks on there. Then we go Overkill. You know, got to have some Overkill on there.
Sure.
Do I have to put any of your bands on there? Or do I?
No. We weren't heavy enough. I never got the cred on your side, baby.
No cred. Listen, but you guys, you know, took off. Maybe you'd be the album closer. It's like a palate cleanser.
Yeah, just like, hey, I listen to some, right? Yeah.
Dillinger. Gotta have Dillinger jam on there. Gotta have some Thursday on there.
Okay.
Gotta have some My Chem on there. Gotta have El Nino represent. Kind of like,
what are we thinking about, like the old school, like Skid Row, Trickster?
I mean, Bon Jovi. And, well, it's really Bon Jovi and it's Bruce are like the kings of all kings. But I feel like they're like too good to be on there. Like, we're not educating anyone by putting them on there. You know?
No, you'd have to go Skid Row or Southside Johnny or something, a little deeper cut. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I almost feel remiss in even making a compilation like this because it's so autobiographical. Right? Like, am I the guy really to describe the whole thing? I can tell you what I like out of that scene, I feel like it's being a little, I'm just projecting a little bit. Like, hey, listen, here's the shit I think.
Yeah, but if you're not the guy, someone else is going to pretend to be the guy, Doc.
I know. So I'm just saying, like, it's very self-centered. You know, it's going to be for the love of, it's going to be train of thought.
Right, I was just about to ask how many FTLO songs would be on there.
Several, you know, definitely got, see this thing, Bulldoze Before My Day, but you got to put some Bulldoze on there. All right. So Fury 5.
Sure.
Gotta go on there. We got you know, the streets have to speak. Saves the Day has to go on there, right? Dead Guy.
All right.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Who am I missing? Actually, should I put some like Ripping Corpse, like some old school like death metal people don't even know about?
Yeah. What about like Discordance Axis or Human Remains?
Nah. Human Remains. Human Remains goes on there. That's Human classic. Remains.
Okay.
Where else do we go?
Let's give Chris Ross a little love. Let's give Nora a little love. Just for fun.
Okay. Just for you. It's great, Chris. See me? I'm doing this because Benny asked. Sorry, I was going to leave you off because I was just being a dick. I'm just kidding. I feel like I mean, do I have to put like the Fugees on there or some shit? Like, just let people know? Like, you know,
well, I was
by
saying
nature.
Heavy music, guitar music, you know, but yeah. So, I mean, if we open up the hip hop world, that opens up a whole number of, you know, once you open up like hip hop, soul, that kind of music from New Jersey, that opens up a whole nother category. So what's going on? I want to know what's going on with the Wedding Band, one of the coolest mixes of stuff I've seen. I saw you playing a Billy Idol song somewhere. And I'm like, what the fuck is even going on here? I was thinking two things. I was like, A, that's Doc on stage with the guy from Ugly Kid Joe, which took me one way. And then I'm like, that's Doc on stage with fucking Kirk Hammett, which took me another way. So what, how did that even like come to pass? And like, what's going on with that?
I got to tour with Metallica in 2009. I was filling in for Lamb of God. So I got to meet the guys. They were awesome. And then fast forward, when I moved to LA, I was doing this cover band with Ken Schalk from Candiria. Shout out.
Sure.
And Ken was filling in for Rob's other band called Mass Mental, which is this really cool band with like Benji from Skindred the actual drummer in that band is Brooks Wackerman. Was in Religion. Now he plays in Avenged Sevenfold.
Yeah, sure.
So he was filling in for Brooks, and it's one part of the set where they do Black Sabbath. They need a guitar player. It's a two bass player band. It's Rob Trujillo and this guy Armand Sebelecho, and they just have a guitar player for this one little Black Sabbath segment of the set, which Whitfield also sings on. And they were looking for guitar players. People they wanted weren't really available. Somehow my name came up, and it was asked to come down. Jam these songs, these Sabbath songs, did it. Ended up doing the gig. It was like, literally, I said the first thing I did when I moved to LA. So it's like 2014. And I'd only been in LA maybe a couple months. It was like Ozzy was at the show and Stuart Copeland from The Police was at the show when Duff McKagan was there. And I was like, holy shit, this is crazy. Did the gig and And, you know, the thing was kind of cool. Like when we, even when I got there, like I just, you know, set my all my shit up and like Armand just starts playing. And I just started like jamming. Like I just started playing
right
with them and kind of like, and I think, with that and, you know, Rob just saw that I wasn't like intimidated, you know, and that I was like, I just kind of flowed. And so he called me the day after the game. Yeah. And he goes, man, he's like, you did a great job. He's like, I love your feel. I love your attitude. He's like, you're going to do great here. And he just kept calling me to like do, like we ended up doing another gig because the bass player couldn't do it. So I was just basically like the second guy. We played like this award show thing. And then and I wasn't even the main guitar player because he would have this other guy who was the main guitar player. So they had other gigs where I would just rehearse with the band. But then this other guy would do the gig, but it's like, I don't care. Rob called, you just show up. And then kind of around the time Bad Wolves started getting busy, Metallica had a new album. So they were really busy too. So we always stay in touch. Like he like tried to help me get the Suicidal Tendencies gig, but I was busy with Bad Wolves. And he would always like, you know, he's trying to get me to do this, what's the other band? Infectious Grooves. He was like trying to get me on the gig with that. And
right.
So we were always in touch. And then I heard about the wedding band thing. I was on, you know, on tour and I was like, oh, that's fucking cool. And then he calls me. He goes, hey man, do you think you could do rehearsal? Just fill in for Kirk and just be like, just play Kirk at rehearsal. And I was like, and it turns out I had this time off. And I was like, fuck yeah, I'll be there. You know, it was a lot of songs. Yeah. Some of the songs we had already did with Mass Mental, but I remember feeling like, oh man, I really want to be good, but I felt like I was not quite as prepared as I wanted to be, but I did as much as I could. Then we did the rehearsal and it was like, it was fucking great. Like it sounded really good. And I was like, as long as I got through it, I was like, all right, I didn't screw anything up and I thought it sounded good and it was fun and wrapping up my shit and I'm like putting my stuff away and I'm just like, man, it's like, you sounded really good, man. It's like, would you want to do the show? And I was like, what? And he's like, it was like the day before, or like I had to start a tour. And he's like, well, let me make some calls. Let me see if I can get you on the show. And then he comes back and he's like, yeah, it's really not much room in the budget. And I'm like, oh, all right. But then I didn't think about it. Now already my wheels are already turning. I got all psyched up. I was like, well, what if I can fly myself there? You think I can maybe do it?
He's like, yeah, right.
I'll call you later. And then he called me back a couple hours later. He goes, if you can fly yourself there, then we'll have you do the gig. So it was very fly by the seat of the pants. So I just flew in to Toronto, like red eye, no sleep, shot. I had to go right in rehearsal. Then the next day, you know, like we do the gig. You know, it was sick, man. It was like really fucking fun and like it was bugged out, you know, like I think I got the gig because I was really well prepared and he felt that it would make the band better. And, you know, as long as Kirk was okay with it, cause it's like, you know, it's a one guitar player band and you like another guitar player, you don't want to like step on anyone's toes or anything like that. Right. So, you know, it was fun. And then, you know, what was it, 6 months later or something? Get another email. Hey, man, we got an offer to do another gig. You know, can you do it? And it was like, if this is going to be like a, because last time we were doing a, was at a music store. It was almost like a showcase more than a show. And this was at like a theater. Yeah, yeah. And it was like, there's going to be tons of, you know, we had like almost a week of rehearsals in LA, almost a week of rehearsals in South Carolina. And it was like, all, you know, it was through Live Nation and turned out I was free. And so we ended up doing the second gig and it was a lot more work, a lot more stress. My back ended up going out like at sound check. But it was cool, man. And I felt same thing. I'm always things like this. I always feel like just be humble. Shut your mouth unless you should open your mouth, you know, just be like a fly on the wall and be reliable, be prepared. But be like a sponge, you know, just try and like absorb, you know, lessons from all these great veterans, you know, these just really exceptional musicians. And, so, man, it was, and that one was like, I said, a much broader experience because we were We just rehearsed a lot more, got to spend a ton of time in South Carolina. And the thing that's great about them, and they're very family oriented. It's like every night you go out with everyone. We go to dinner every night. The whole band, all the, you know, the security people, everyone, it's like, boom, we're all together.
Oh, cool.
Like it's, and they really put an emphasis on like doing, being like, there's the playing, but they really value like the social aspect of what bands are. You know,
which is well, yeah, it was a trip seeing you up there, man. It truly was. I was like, oh, yeah, shit, look, it's Kirk Hammett on that side, and there's Doc. That's crazy. So I was super happy to see it.
Yeah, man, it's a cool thing. But at the same time, I also almost don't like getting too hyped up on it, because then I think you know, because who knows, maybe one day they're like, you know, we're going to get someone else. And you're like, oh, okay. You know, like you can't.
Right.
I'm not the type of person where I like to kind of put too many notches on my belt because of things I already did. You know, it's always like, what's the next thing? How are you moving forward? How are you, you know? So I'm I'll try to get too hyped up on it and just, you know, just cross my fingers and call me the next time and we get to do it again. But we're on like a group text and we kind of like, you know, send messages to each other. Everyone was just reminiscing because it's been about a year since the last gig. So and that's literally the last thing I did before lockdown was that gig. So I was like home for like a week, and then it was like everything was shut down.
So cool, man. I got to meet them once and I had the same experience, just like completely terrified. I mean, one of my first favorite bands in the world. And I remember meeting Kirk and remember Lars, and I'm just like, oh, that was a shockingly normal interaction that I was not expecting to play out like that, which is very, well, very cool.
I mean, the thing about them is they're real. They know part of their job is like public relations. So I think they're really good. They're used to like people freaking
politics?
Out.
They're just being nice to me because of politics.
No, I just think they like what I'm saying is like, they're not awkward about the fact that they meet people all the time that are like, holy shit. Like they know how to put people at ease,
right?
You know, who sure, are, you know,
sure. Right.
Like they're not the type of band where they are in the band and they just hide and they don't engage with people. Like they're really, they really take seriously the part of dealing with the public and being a human being and showing gratitude to people that like what they do, you know?
Sure.
And so I think they have, you know, like in a way it is like a politician. It really is, because it's part of their, I think they see it as part of their jobs and they take it really seriously to like, just be like, you know, just be humanistic and just like recognize that and respect that, you know? And so it's something I'm, like I said, I try, and with bands like that and people on that level, I try and absorb the lessons of like, this is how you should be.
Yeah.
Like, dude, even when I toured with them, they were so cool. Like they invited all the bands out to this restaurant in Montreal just to hang out with the bands. No crew, no, and just the bands from like midnight to like 5 a.m.
Wow.
They don't have to do that, but it's important to them. Yeah. And it goes to show you that the biggest bands are also the, you know, a lot of times the most generous. And I don't think it's they got big and became generous. I think that generosity and kind of that spirit, I think, helps cultivate the success. At least I think so.
1,000%. No, I think you're right. I mean, we've been getting into this. I mean, essentially anybody who ever comes on to this show who's been in a band with the same members for more than 10 to 15 years, I usually pose that question. Like, how do you do it? You know, what's the style of keeping this all together? And what's the communication trick or the mastery? And almost always, like, from what you're saying, there's just sort of this top-down humility and openness with your band, the rest of your band, the whole crew, the fans. Like, you don't get competitive. You don't get you know, angry with anyone else. It's just like, you know, there's work, there's friends, we figure it out, and then we keep moving forward. Metallica definitely has that. I mean, Lars Ulrich introduced my band once holding a bowl of fruit salad. And it's one of the notches on my belt. I'm not like you, Doc. I put the notch on and then I wear it till I die. That's my style.
You just put the gut over the belt and let the gut, you just lower the pants. Let the gut come out. Actually, well, one thing Quest Love said that I always think about, he says the key to any band success in keeping, and they've had the same members for a while, time, the Roots. He said you should have planned activities outside of work where the band hangs out together and does things, whether that's going bowling or having dinner or whatever. He's like, that's the key. It's the to have a friendship outside of just the business of just playing. And I was like, good to know. And he was saying it like, I'm giving you advice, take my advice. Not to me personally, but I forget where I read it or saw it somewhere. Right.
Like, this is a tool. Yeah, a real tool. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Doc, we've had you on for like 4.5 hours, and I appreciate it. You're the best. So I've been asking people, you know, in the era of pandemic, is there any kind of book, film, podcast, something that's kind of helping you keep your perspective or just giving you some joy in this interesting time?
I'm reading a book right now and I'm forgetting the name of it. Oh, it's like The Obstacle is the Way, I think is what it's called. And Chris Kell from Five Finger Death Punch gave it to me. It's kind of a little bit of that in every crisis, there's an opportunity kind of idea. But that when you have a difficult challenge, that the solutions are in there. Like, that is actually the point where you can develop yourself or find an opportunity to grow or whatever. So it's a way of just kind of, you know, a lot of that stuff gets repeated in a lot of kind of self-help literature and things like that. But it doesn't make it ever any less true. Right. So they take a lot of historical examples in this book to, you know, they talk about, like, was it Carnegie, one of these old rich motherfuckers, about how like they developed their company during the Great Depression. Right. That like while everyone was freaking out, they were, all right, what can we do? So it's this idea of like kind of just skewing your mind to see things differently. You know, like a lot of people, they have a bad situation. They panic and they're like, you know, everything's fucked. It's all, you know, and it's just, all you got to do is just shift your mind around it and like look at it from a different angle and realize, oh no, it's actually an opportunity. So that's something I've been reading. I still need to finish it. It's a short book and I still haven't finished it. But as far as other things, I don't know if have you guys seen this YouTuber ContraPoints? So it's a trans woman does it's my favorite YouTube channel, and she does these long, like hour and a half, very entertaining, elaborate kind of, you know, video essays on particular subjects, but she's brilliant. And I love getting, you know, she did one on J.K. Rowling, you know, kind of about the trans thing, that whole thing. But it's wonderful to hear that from a trans woman's perspective who understands like what that process is like and what the community is like. And she's very like, she has a very 360 degree angle and really looks at things from everyone's point of view and is very non-judgmental, even with people she disagrees with. So I think that's brilliant. There's this really cool thing on Hulu called In and of Itself. It's a It's a filming of a live show, like a one-man show. This guy who's like a magician who kind of created this this one-man show kind of around, I don't know, the emotional center point of humanity. It's really hard to describe, but I definitely recommend people watch it in and of itself on Hulu. Check that out.
Brad, this is a perfect opportunity to get our Hulu sponsorship now. Remember, you'll watch that show on Hulu.
Hulu.com/goingofftrack.
Get that
right,
back.
Thanks for all this. I really appreciate you.
No problem.
Taking all this time on a Monday.
On a fucking Monday.
And I hope I see your face in person one day soon.
Damn straight. I got a mustache now, so now I'm allowed to hang.
Yeah. Well, Doc, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Fun. All right.
Thank you both. This was a lot of fun. And anytime, you know, one thing about me is I love talking about me. So just.
Whoa.
Wow.
I got schooled.
I got laid out. Laid out.
That was definitely worth it.
It's nice though, isn't it? It's nice to have some real discourse these days, you know, like we're actually a couple people can just go, you know, head to head for a minute, respectfully, and try to work through some things. I think
he got me thinking. I admit it. Yeah,
there's some truth to a lot of what he's saying. I mean, you know, I walk away from some of it thinking the same exact thing I did before, still respecting his opinion, but of course it's, a lot of it really makes me think. But Brad, you know what helps when I can't think too much?
Pouring hot sauce up your nose.
Well, I love a good meal. I realized this last night. I was like, after like a 2-hour interview, I'm so like tweaked out. I drink a giant cup of coffee and I'm just all immersed in this thing.
Ooh.
And I'm like, I need to either exercise or eat or something after this. And I don't know about you, but I like spicy food.
Yeah.
And I've been using this smoky habanero from the Silk City hot sauce.
I like that one a lot. I like the Badass Jew is probably a close second for me.
Yeah, that's hot. The Badass Jew.
Today for lunch, I took Slurp, which is another flavor, put it in, mixed it with mayonnaise and put it on a chicken po' boy. And it was
like
Caribbean style sandwich. So good.
And you know what the best thing about it is for me is I never know what I'm allowed to bring into my house, you know? Like if I bring some processed food, something like, you know, that the book The Dirt Cure doesn't have in it or something. You know, it just gets before I know it, it's like out on the side. And I'm like, wait, we didn't even finish this yet. Like why is it out on the side of the house? But the cool thing about this is it's all locally grown, small batch peppers, no synthetics inside of it, all just natural, good, hearty, local stuff.
From Vermont,
which is like the best natural place there is, you know?
What about that artwork?
Yeah, and this cool pulp artwork.
It's like real comic book artists.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's very cool.
I'm not often presented with something that I mind shilling for. But when something this cool, DIY, it's just guy named Jeff who's making it. And it's a great little company. I love the art. I love the food. There's nothing about this I mind shilling for. It's not like fucking, you know, like I'm working for Exxon here. This is a nice little hot sauce company. And best part about it is if you use our promo code GOT at silkcityhotsauce.com, you get a free bottle of hot sauce. And you get stickers, and you get 15% off your first order. Not so bad. So I think people should eat some hot sauce for us. Thanks for everyone to tuning into this episode with Mr. Doc Coyle.
It really turned out well. I didn't know where this was going to go.
I know you were scared. I know you were scared. And I didn't even get, you didn't even know. Doc is a huge basketball fan, and it's one of the things that very much connects us. We've been on a texting chain with his friend Luke, who's a Philadelphia 76ers fan, or our friend Luke, excuse me, and Doc, who's a Knicks fan, and me as a Nets fan, it got so contentious last season that the text exchange stopped because it got so hot in there. Not because of Doc, because of me and Luke, I'm afraid. But yeah, so I had a whole line of questioning about the Knicks, his first time at the Garden, all that. We didn't even get to it. Lucky you.
Yeah.
But it's so cool. I have an awful lot of respect for Doc. He's got a interesting road coming up, but he's such a bright and talented fellow. I think he's going to make through everything fine. And I'm super excited to hear their new music with whoever they choose. I mean, Doc is in, we got guys from God Forbid and Devil Driver. Like, they could just write music and I'd be into it, you know?
But if you want to catch up with Doc, it's Doc Coyle, Instagram and Twitter, DocCoyle, Facebook, Doc Coyle Official. As you heard, he's got stuff to say and he made me think about some stuff for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, he's been very steadfast for a long time about the way he sees these things, and he's taken shit from a lot of sides, from all sides, for you know, towing a line of trying to keep people together. And it's a noble effort, you know. I think sometimes people don't realize the discipline necessary in trying to keep a level head in times like this. But
and if you would like to make a noble effort, you can go to patreon.com/goingofftrack and donate to the cause. And by cause, I mean this podcast.
Our podcast cause. So you can get off this crazy website. Goodness.
We got a lot of bonus content up there. We're doing a Thursday night fireside chat with all our patrons.
Much fun.
It's so cute. It's fucking cute. And if you want to just give us a tip, Venmo.com/offtrack. That's us. Give us what you want. $1, $2, $5,000.
$100,000. Yeah. What would you do? Say
give him $100,000, gets a free t-shirt.
A free shirt?
Yeah.
That's the paywall. Yeah. What would you really do? Like, let's say tomorrow, I don't know, some hedge fund owner or something was like, wow, I love
I'm gonna fuck with these guys.
Love that Doc Coyle podcast. And then we just get like a Venmo of $100,000. What do we do? What do we do with that? I don't know.
Why are you saying we? You think I'm going to tell you if that happens?
Oh, you motherfucker. I knew this was going to start. See, it starts with jokes. You just planted a seed. You're never going to get out of my head, Brad. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Penny, don't you remember that time we asked for $1 million?
It actually is. Oh, man.
I mean, you noticed my new microphone?
Is that how you get all these hipster New York dad clothes? I didn't know. I've been wearing the same Nets fucking hoodie for a year.
My Converse fucking rubber tracks.
What you got for free?
Leftover.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway. Well, let's get out of here. We've taken enough time. Much respect to Doc. Much respect to Keith David, Kirk Hammett, Rob Trujillo, other people we mentioned in this, Luke Bonenstein for the mystery question. And we're going to see you next week.
All right.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.